Due to the graphic nature of some of the content in this episode, listener discretion is advised. Some stories lie hopelessly shrouded in hearsay and mystery, and those of us interested in learning the truth have to dig for it. Oftentimes, those stories, the ones we have to dig for, are the most important stories to tell. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast longing for resolution, suspended in a cloud of uncertainty. The unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. Earlier this week, I had the opportunity to chat with one of the most well-respected criminal profilers in the country, Mark Safrick. After looking through the ME report, call log, and summaries on the case, Mark provided me with his thoughts on Matt's murder, based off years of experience.
I was a cop in California, started in patrol, promoted into detectives, worked for the PD as a detective about 3.5 years. At that time, I ended up going to a two-week homicide school where we had some FBI profilers that came out to give us some interesting discussion about how they looked at violent crimes, homicide, from a behavioral perspective. It was really a turning point for me. I became fascinated with that. I was working a couple of very interesting homicide cases that were unsolved. And it started my relationship with the FBI's behavioral unit back in Quantico. I applied to the FBI, got in.
What year was that you started with the FBI?
1984. My first assignment really was working violent crimes on an Indian reservation in Wyoming.
Kind of sounds like the show Longmire.
Longmire theoretically takes place in the county that I worked in and on the Indian reservation that I worked. It was Fremont County.
Really?
I worked all the violent crimes on the res. After, I actually had worked in the Bureau for about 11 years before positions opened up in the Behavioral Analysis Unit. I applied and was promoted into the unit as a supervisory special agent, and I finished my career there. I spent almost 13 years in the behavioral unit. I published quite a bit of research, lectured all over the world, worked a lot of very fascinating cases, spent 23 years in the FBI before retiring, and I do complex analyses of violent crimes. And I've looked at some of the documents that you sent me, and I've looked at sort of summary information. I have to say that I'm very leery about making assessments without really looking at the information that's been produced during the investigation. I don't like to make threshold diagnoses because I don't really know what the information that has been uncovered says. I'm cautious about saying things sort of definitive. I would tell you things that I think are interesting.
From what you saw, was there anything that stood out to you in the autopsy or the summary or anything about the case that you would flag as particularly interesting?
Well, I think there were a lot of things that I thought were interesting. To come into a residential neighborhood that doesn't have a lot of crime or hardly any crime, break into a residence, you know, go upstairs and kill somebody with a firearm that makes a very loud report that neighbors could hear.
I think you're probably, out of everyone I've talked to, you're probably the most qualified to answer this based off the autopsy ME report. There were 2 caliber of bullets listed. It's been suggested to me that those 2 bullets couldn't have come from the same gun.
Right. That's true. That's one dynamic of this that I think is very important to understand. It's very, very unusual to see a single offender carrying more than one weapon.
So when you look at the autopsy and you see a large caliber weapon and you see a medium caliber weapon, both firearms, you know, in my experience of having looked at thousands of homicide cases, so it would suggest that you probably have more than one individual. And again, that's unusual because breaking into a residence at night is typically that's a singular activity by one individual. Because he has defensive injuries, it appears on both his left hand and his right hand, defending himself against the edged weapon attack. There's the injury to his left arm that looks like it's part of the same shot that goes through the left side of his face. And I would want to know, you know, where are the bullets? Because some of his wounds exit and some of them don't. So I want to know where the bullets are that exited, because they exited his body. So where are those bullets? You know, are they found in the bed or in the headboard or in the wall by the bed, or are some of those inflicted while he's in the bathroom?
Probably read of the 100 minutes that it took for police to enter the home.
I think
right?
The 100-minute gap, it bothers me in one sense, that because police, when they got there, knew that shots had been fired, knew that she had an injury, and I don't even know what that injury is. It's listed as a shot in her hand, but in another location it's mentioned as in her arm.
Yeah.
I don't know. What I think they said was they suspected there might be a hostage situation because there was a child in the house, and they were, they were calling their CERT team, their special enforcement response team, or their SWAT team. I think that if shots are fired and it appears that someone was trying to kill her husband, that, you know, you've got exigent circumstances. You need to get in there, make sure that, you know, it varies with every agency what their protocol is. And I don't know what information they were provided. Clearly, I mean, I think there's exigent circumstances that you had a child in the house and, I don't know why they thought this was a hostage situation when shots had already been fired, and I don't know what they were relying on, and maybe there's things that I clearly don't know. That aspect for me is less concerning. That they obviously made a decision that they thought they had a hostage situation and they were waiting for their special response team. My focus would be on understanding why he is being killed in this residence at 12:45 in the morning. I would say that it really appears that he's been targeted here, that this wasn't opportunistic. You have offenders coming into the house. This is pretty risky to target him in his residence at night, because there's likely other times when he might be available where there might be less risk for the offender to actually take him out. And it's not very effective, really. You've got multiple gunshot wounds, and then you have all this stabbing going on. So, you know, some anger being perhaps displayed or presented in this scene. But he does have a very significant gunshot wound to his neck, which severs his spinal cord. That's likely a fatal injury nearly immediately, because he's apparently shot first. And I would only say that because his wife reports that she wakes up, there's an offender in the bedroom, at least one she sees, and that there's, you know, a shot is fired. Man, I don't know if it's she's shot first or if she's shot and, all this stabbing, and this appears the stabbing comes later, but he's still alive.
It would start with shooting.
Yeah, why is he
stabbing and then there would be shooting?
Why isn't he dead in the bed? Right? Why is he into the bathroom, and why does he have defensive injuries, and why do we have three different weapons here? I'm very curious how she got out of the room. You look at his injuries, he's got massive amounts of injuries. He's got, looks like 5 gunshot wounds from 2 different guns. He's got multiple stabbing and incised wounds, over a lot of the main area of his body, the head, neck area, his torso, his abdomen, and his back. How did she get out of the room with the child? That's a big risk to let her go. Why let her go? And especially if there's more than one offender. These are questions I would have. And exactly what she did, because at least what I read was that she, you know, had a sense there was someone in the room. So, okay, that's fine. I want to know, what did she do? You know, I would want to look at, you know, her statement and understanding how she didn't sustain any other additional injuries, how she got out of the house, why an offender who's willing to kill her husband to commit murder would allow her to, you know, escape and call, you know, to alert authorities. And it may be explainable based on understanding the whole dynamic.
You know, some have speculated or theorized that this was a professional hit.
You know, I would say from, you know, in my perspective, that was probably extremely unprofessional. Well, I mean, if you're talking about professional hits, they're done with small caliber weapons, typically 22s or 25 autos, and they're quick, and they're, you know, they're headshots, and there's one or two shots, and that's it. You know, this is essentially a mess, this. Getting him, killing him. It's taking two different handguns, and there's all kinds of cutting and stabbing, and there's movement. He's defending himself. He's in the bed. He's in the hall. He's in the bathroom. I mean, it's very unprofessional. It looks like it wasn't done very well. It took time to do it, and it became very messy doing it. I think
right.
More likely that he was the target. He was targeted for homicide. They came to the residence with that in mind. They executed the plan and they left. Targeted is one thing. A professional hit, I would say that it's anything but professional.
Cornell Harris was one of Matt Stewart's best friends. He reached out to me back in June after the first episode aired. And since then, altogether, Cornell and I have probably spent close to 10 hours on the phone talking about growing up with Matt and his thoughts on this murder.
We basically went to school together our entire lives, basically through what we call intramural competition. When we were in middle school, he was a really good soccer player. He was the type of guy that used to like to pick on you a little bit, not pick on you in a way of like trying to degrade you. He was the type of person that would pick on you to make you laugh at yourself. A lot of the stuff that he would do towards me with most of the kids at the time when we were young, said I had a big head. So he used to talk about my head all the time, basically. I even tell my kids now that the head that I have now, I grew into. And that was
That's funny.
Yeah, from that point on, so our relationship didn't get real up and personal until after high school. Even though we had a relationship in high school, we really didn't get close until we were processing into becoming men. As far as his past really didn't begin until, I would say, late senior year, until the time he graduated. Now, the things that he had did, you wouldn't say every kid would go through it, but it's sort of kind of an understandable situation whenever you're a high school kid coming out of high school. You have small expectations of yourself, and you may not go to college, which he didn't directly straight out of high school go to college. He went to community college. So the thing was that he was working, and as time goes by, you meet people, you still have high school friends, and sometimes you can get sucked into a lifestyle that is not necessarily you. He was never the type of person that was, he wasn't a street thug. He wasn't the type of person, even though he may have a history in drugs where he was selling them or taking them or whatever. His demeanor, the inner man that he was not that. He got caught up in a situation like we all did. It was definitely a phase that he went through. As far as people speculating on what kind of street person he was when he was doing that, he was not a quote-unquote major guy, kingpin, or some kind of major seller or user. It was what it was for a short period of time. He had a story that he told me personally about what made him change. And once he went through that process, you know, he changed completely. The stages of being young and going through things. So I had went through a particular trial in 2001. During that time, he was a good friend to me. You know, he gave me a lot of insight on, you know, right and wrong, because he had changed his life and became a Christian. And he would basically not preach to me, but he would give me good information about what he did in order to change. And during that time, I probably would say that was my greatest year of change, 2001 going to 2002. And he was probably the number one person in helping me make a change in my life. Phone calls, visits, whatever it was, he would always, you know, be in my corner when I needed him. Our relationship was tight because we basically grew as men, young men, transitioning to fathers and husbands together. And we would have conversations of insight, him basically telling me about his situations, and I would tell him about my situations. And we would, you know, laugh about some, serious talks about others.
And he was, was he at your wedding?
He was. He was in my wedding. Yeah, he was a groomsman. So, and he also later became the godfather to my kids. And that's because our relationship grew so deep. You know, I just felt, I felt like he was a representative of what I wanted to be. You know, he was just like a guy who I looked upon that whenever he came around or he called, it'd bring me back home.
Yeah.
The one thing about him, man, he had a lot of love, man. He was like, whenever he would comment about people who at that time he may have drifted away from, it was always in love. He was always like, never condemning. He wasn't like, man, I don't go around them anymore because they're doing this. He would be like, man, I'm praying for them and I still got love for them and I'd love to see them. As far as enemies, he didn't have any.
Really?
Right. Man, no matter what went on, I have a son now that is handicapped. He wouldn't even know if my son was doing well or if he wasn't. He would call. He would say, man, how's Buddy doing? That's my son's name. And I'd tell him. And he'd be like, man, you mind if I pray? So we get on the phone and he'd pray for my son from wherever he was, encouraging me and encouraging him. Our relationship was deeper than a lot of people knew because he was like a spiritual guide for me.
Where were you and what were you doing when you got news that he had passed?
So I'm sitting in my couch and I get a phone call and I didn't believe it. And I was like, what? And from there, I called a friend, a mutual friend of ours. And he confirmed it. And I was in total disbelief.
The way that he's been described to me and the way that you're describing him is the last person in the world you would think something like that would happen to. You didn't have any idea who could have done this.
No. My feeling during the process of going before the funeral, during the funeral, after the funeral was, man, it was devastating. It really was. It was totally devastating. And the speculation, couldn't pinpoint it. For somebody to viciously go in and do what they did, you know, you just can't think of who would do something of that nature to a guy who I would think had no enemies at all, period. To be 100% honest, before this podcast had started, I would always, every year, think of on that date about it heavily. And I never did understand why there wasn't a major push to solve the murder. The chase of trying to figure out what happened. I felt at times as though the case was dead. I felt like there was no way. Too much time had passed away. I may be wrong. From the outside looking in, nobody was majorly interested, and then lo and behold, here comes this podcast. And whenever the podcast came out, I'll be honest with you, I was brought to tears when I first heard it because I felt like now it's on the way to justice. Just by publicly putting it in a persona where some people can hear the what's going on, whether it's speculation or fact, it's going to bring back up his name and try to process the situation into being solved. The thing that I would tell people who listen to this podcast is this. No matter how you see it, this is God's work. And I do believe that this podcast is going to create a platform in some way to where this murder is going to be solved. Whether you agree with it, whether you disagree with the podcast, understand that this man had a life. This man had things that he inspired to be greater than what he was. Justice has to be served. This man is well-deserving, along with his family, of the truth coming out and this murder finally coming to an end. You know, I feel like closure is something that everybody deserves no matter what.
Another one of Matt's close family friends reached out a few weeks back, and he had some interesting things to say, though he asked that I not reveal his identity.
I was excited when you first came out with the podcast. I was like, wow, this is awesome. You do a really great job. You know, it's been many years. We used to sit behind Matt in church and watch him look over and glance at her, and we'd poke him or something and laugh at him, you know, those sort of things. What are you looking at her for? Stuff like that. And he'd say, what are you talking about? So, yeah, we used to have a lot of fun with him, kidding him about it and everything. But, you know, after they got married, we spent a lot of time with them. Years later, when all that happened to Matt, I mean, that was, like, devastating news. My wife calls me and tells me the news, and I just fell to the ground. It was just devastating to us. I was, because, you know, Matt, I considered him a good friend, even though I hadn't known him that long. He was just, you know, one of those guys.
He's one of those guys that no one has a bad thing to say about him.
He never had anything bad to say about anybody. He really didn't. That day, we went to the church because they had a lot of people over praying and meeting in the church. And then they had most of the family and friends were over at Matt's grandmother's house. And so we went over there. Everyone's, you know, crying, upset, all that. And something I thought was odd was that Brenda...
And this is Brenda, Matt's mother-in-law?
Yeah. She had her story that she just kept telling. Her story was down pat. Like, she was at home. She woke up, she said she had a real bad feeling. She just went on over to Matt and Angel's house, and she was just going to stay there until they get up, and because she was supposed to go there anyway and help clean the house or something. Well, I understand she got there. Then, from what I remember her saying, she got there just after it all happened. Police wouldn't let her in, that sort of thing. She's trying to get into the house to get to Matt to make sure he's okay and all that, but the police wouldn't let her in. That was what she was saying back then, anything like that. I just thought it was odd. He had some times there when I would spend around him where he just wanted to talk sometimes, and he would, you know, talking with Matt one evening, we were out by the water or something, and he was just saying, you know, do you believe that God really forgives us for everything? And I was like, yeah, as far as I know, yeah. He was like, well, I hope so. And he's like, I was involved with some really bad stuff, you know, a long time ago with some really bad people. And he said, I did a lot of really bad things, and I just hope that I'm forgiven. I was like, well, yeah, you know. I tried to say, well, so what did you do or who are you involved with? And he's like, I don't want to say. I don't want to talk about it.
That seems kind of very uncharacteristic of him.
Hard to believe about Matt. You know, they were having some financial trouble.
The specifics were about what was going wrong, or
basically they had so much debt. Their house, their vehicles, just having to pay for all that. Matt was very stressed out a lot. This is something too. I remember Matt talking about, before all this happened, that he was thinking about getting a gun. He had to be prepared, basically, you know, in case anything ever happened, he can protect his family, that sort of thing. It, you know, he didn't really go into it too much from what I can remember. I just remember those comments. He was thinking about getting something, just didn't know quite what to get.
How long before he was murdered did those conversations happen? Do you remember?
You know, I think it was around a month. Yeah, so it wasn't far out.
Do you think that he knew that he was in danger?
I don't know. Maybe he did. I don't know. You know, like we talked about before, they did have financial troubles, and Matt was always worried about finances. He's been stressed out a lot.
The more I dug into these accounts, the more I wondered whether or not Matt may have realized that he was in danger in the days and weeks prior to his murder. I've been bombarded with tips and rumors about the circumstances surrounding Matt's death. I've spent hours on the phone, doing cold calls and follow-ups, trying to substantiate some of the various things I've heard. Some claims I was able to thoroughly explore. Still, there are plenty of other rabbit trails, the end of which I never reached. Some of the leads I left on the table, and they'll likely haunt me for a long time to come. Speaking of which, the following is from a call I received back in June from someone in the Gabriel Estates neighborhood who claimed to have heard an interesting story from a man who had been the Stewart's neighbor at the time of Matt's murder.
Well, go ahead then. Tell me what you've heard some things from.
Yeah, so it's my understanding a few days to maybe a week before all of the events happened that there was some type of scuffle, either verbally and or somewhat physically, between Matt and some other gentleman.
Did they say where this took place?
It was in the driveway.
It was in the driveway?
Yeah, so it was outside.
So was it a physical altercation?
I don't know if it ever got physical. They had just said that there were people, that they knew that there was some type of argument, disagreement when someone came over who was a male, but I'm not 100% on that.
Okay. Wait, is what they told you that they heard this happen, heard about it happening, or actually heard the altercation?
I think they saw.
They saw it?
Obviously, after this conversation, I became laser focused on getting an interview with the neighbor who had supposedly seen this altercation. I first connected with him back in July, but it was weeks before I actually got him on the phone for an extended conversation. Of course, I was anxious to confirm what I had heard about his seeing Matt fighting with someone in the driveway days before his death, but this neighbor was quick to clarify something that made this whole thing a bit underwhelming. To this day, I haven't been able to track down where this account of Matt fighting with someone in his driveway originated, or if there's any truth to it at all. Nevertheless, my conversation with this particular neighbor ended up being far more illuminating than I anticipated.
So I can go ahead and record this?
Yeah.
I'm recording a podcast about the unsolved murder of Matt Stewart, and I wondered if you'd be willing for me to ask you some questions on the podcast.
I would rather not.
You know, I have had other people that not comfortable using their name, and I changed their voice. So if you'd be okay with that.
I mean, I wouldn't see why not.
Okay. So what I had heard that, you know, made me want to reach out to you, that you had seen something at the Stewart house a week or so before Matt was killed, like a fight between Matt and another person.
That's not true with me.
That's not true. Okay.
Well, no, I had heard it from one of the other neighbors. But they said that they had seen him argue with somebody.
That night, I mean, how did you figure out something was wrong? Like, did you hear gunshots?
No. This is why I kind of didn't want to do any recordings or nothing. Because, so, how much of this have you really learned so far?
Are you talking about the actual...
So, the whole deal happens, right? I'm in bed sleeping, and my phone's ringing. Come to find out, it was Michelle down the road. So, Michelle had Hannah spending the night over there. So the police supposedly went down there and woke her up because they heard Hannah was there. And she called and woke me up and told me about it. I went out my front door to a bunch of policemen. Where this supposedly happened was right outside my bedroom window. And my dog never barked or nothing.
You didn't hear any gunshots?
No.
Do you think you would have heard gunshots?
Well, let me put it to you this way. When they cleaned the whole entire house afterwards, because the bathroom was so saturated with blood, supposedly, they had to hang all new plywood, sheetrock, and everything. And I was in my bathroom taking a shit one day, and I heard the screw gun.
You heard what?
The screw gun for hanging up the fucking sheetrock.
But you couldn't hear...
Supposedly he was shot with a .38 and a .40 caliber.
Yeah, no, that's right.
So a .38 and a .40 ain't a fucking quiet gun. There's way too many things that add up to A, the police department fucking up, and B, people knowing what the hell's going on and not getting it done. The kids always played, and Matt was always playing football with the neighborhood kids. Like that little corner of the world, we all the kids played together and hung out. Laugh, you know what I'm saying? That's another thing that I don't get, is how Angel went to the hospital and left Hannah down the road and in the house. A kid that was on the medical crew told me he took her to the hospital.
Do you have a, like, do you, Do you know more about, like, what could have possibly been going on?
From everything I always knew of them two, they were just two happy people. I mean, they were both going to nursing school, and they didn't even have cable TV for a while. You know what I mean?
Just kind of down to earth.
Yeah, from what I saw of it all. Now, you know her mom lived down behind the Concord Mills Mall. So for her to be up there at 1 o'clock in the morning, she supposedly had a bad dream. Tell me a woman who's lived on her own for 30 years or whatever all of a sudden has a bad dream and she's going to go to her daughter's house? Did you hear about the box fan and shit in the bedroom door?
No.
All right, well, supposedly, you know, because it was a two-story home with a single unit AC, you know what I'm saying? But they had a box fan sitting in the door room, the bedroom door frame, basically, blowing into the bedroom. But supposedly, this box fan never got knocked over in the door frame through all of this.
Jesus Christ. Did you hear anything about there not being any shell casings at the scene?
Yeah. Yeah. And then supposedly they found some shell casing in Brenda's car and towed it off. Well, I saw it get towed. The State Bureau investigators, they told me that she was went to the gun range target shooting. That's what they were. That's what they told me. That's why they didn't know at the time. But supposedly they were different and she was target shooting.
So it was just kind of a coincidence.
So now I got another one for you. You probably didn't hear this one, but... So I lived next door. I traveled for a living at the time. So there ain't no flipping way I was going out of town with my family sitting there when all this happened. On Wednesday night at about 10 o'clock, I packed up my entire house, dog, everything, locked my house up completely and left and went to Michigan. I went and dropped my whole family off at a family member's house so I knew they were good. Now, even my stepfather, he asked me, he says, did you kill that motherfucker? He says, well, it's just weird that all of a sudden you have to come up here with your whole family. I said, no. I said, I'm telling you the God's honest truth. I just wasn't leaving my home. 3 months later, the State Bureau realized they never investigated us or talked to us.
You know, I've been trying to get a hold of you for a couple months. I talked with the lead investigator, and I told him that story that I heard from neighbors about Matt fighting with someone, and I gave him your name. And have they contacted you?
No.
See, that's weird. Right?
Because that's what I'm saying. There's too many things that don't add up in this case that involves the police department and the State Bureau investigator.
I mean, dude, I have a very, very good friend of mine who is a Bronx homicide detective. And I called him when this happened. And he knows all the details of it. He's like, what in the fuck are they doing down here?
There's people within this area that knows exactly what happened. Something somewhere has happened. And somebody told them that if everybody keeps this hush-hush, that everybody else will be fine.
So that's probably why they don't like my podcast very much.
Correct.
I think that if there's someone that doesn't want this to come out, they're not going to go after them. They're going to come after me.
Well, I mean, if you know how people are.
In the first episode, I spoke with a local journalist, Jonathan Weaver, who had tried to do a story on the case back in 2016 for the Statesville Record and Landmark. His article was eventually scrapped due to the lack of willing participation and pushback from the victim's family. Jonathan has been a huge help throughout this entire process. Before wrapping up the season, I wanted to circle back and get Jonathan's thoughts on how the podcast has progressed.
I think you did a very admirable job. I think you did the best you could under the circumstances. You checked off as many boxes as you could. The difficulty that I had early on, I assumed that was going to be the case. The difficulty with finding people to talk about it, that was the thing that registered with me. And, you know, we discussed that when you first reached out to me, that, you know, I told you about my experience. And, you know, ultimately, it's a shame that there's not more people willing to come forward and talk. But, you know, at this point, you've done what you could, I think. You've probably devoted a lot more time to it than you originally thought you would. Am I correct in saying that?
That's the damn truth.
It would take somebody who, you know, who had a lot of time on their hands and who had the passion to really want to tell the story. Really, it becomes a full-time job if you want to do it right. That was the big thing. I couldn't devote all of my time And so now, you know, the decision has to be made, well, do I keep going? Do I keep pushing? Do I keep trying to find things out? Or do I just, you know, let it go and hope that something happens? And whether something else would happen with it, I really honestly couldn't tell you. I mean, would you, if you had it to do over again, would you do it at this point right now?
Well, I won't say no, but I would say that I would have spent a little bit longer trying to get someone else to do it. That they know that they could know if they wanted to.
Right. They just don't want to know.
They don't want to know. And I think that that's incredulous. I really do. I hope to God that I would never do that to a friend of mine. That no matter who it is, I would stare them down and say, hey, if you know something, you better tell me. I don't care what you do in response. If you want to say our friendship is over for me asking questions, then so be it. His life ought to be worth a lot more than that, than not wanting to upset other people. I mean, he was murdered. I mean, I'm I apologize if I upset anyone, or if anyone's made to feel uncomfortable. A man lost his life.
And there's your closing statement right there. That's the way I would end it.
Angel called my wife 2 days later and told her not to worry, you will be fine.
What?
2 days later, my wife got a phone call from Angel and was told, do not worry, your family's going to be fine.
What do you think she was trying to say?
I don't know.
Did she seem like upset? Did she seem like...
Like everything was fine. You probably got more than you bargained for when you called me. There's something. There's something big.
The murder of Matt Stewart is wrought with perplexing details, hazy recollections, and rabid rumors. After months of in-depth investigating, I'm left with more questions than when I started. But if I've learned anything from doing this podcast, it's that more information about this crime is out there, and there are likely people in the community who are holding out on investigators. For those responsible for Matt's murder, the veil of silence around this case only works in their favor. I hope that this podcast helps to jumpstart conversations and strengthens the resolve of investigators to find justice for Matt. And I pray that experienced investigative reporters will take the time to dive into this mystery. To any who consider looking into this case, I promise you, there's a lot underneath the surface if you just take the time to dig. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, with audio production and backing tracks by myself and the infamous Ninja Man, Matt Garrett. Special thanks to Jonathan Weaver, Mark Safrick, and Cornell Harris for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.